It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Corliss housing development in Milwaukee is now renting units. The apartments are located on property that once contained an old landfill and some vacant buildings.
Eventually, the Corliss will contain 576 apartments, including 144 for seniors in 8 buildings. All of the units are reserved for households making no more than 80% of the area's median income.
While the development was supported with tax cuts and some public funding, it is considered the largest private affordable housing development in state history. To find out how it came together, we have the project's developer. S.R. Mills is CEO of Bear Development. That's the Kenosha-based company that owns and manages real estate property around the country. S.R., welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Your company has housing developments all over the country. What makes the Corliss in Milwaukee unique?
Well, it's unique from a lot of levels. One of them is its size. At 576 units, it's the largest single housing development that we've done, and it's actually the largest affordable housing development in the state's history.
Leasing is underway, I understand. People have started moving in. Are the units filling? What do you see?
Yeah, they are. You know, it's actually 8 buildings over about a 10-acre property. And right now, we're about halfway through the leasing process. We look to deliver our last building August of 26. We delivered our first one August of 25. And we're about 50% leased up, so it's going quite well.
The project, it cost more than $185 million to put together, and you utilized bank loans and tax incremental financing. You used a Milwaukee Brownfield loan and National Housing Trust funds, among other sources. Was this project more complicated to put together than your other developments?
Well, they're all complicated, but this one certainly had its perils. We originally looked at utilizing historic tax credits and trying to redevelop what was an old industrial complex. And COVID hit, costs went up, and we had to rethink and reimagine the project in general.
How did you do that? What were the steps you took?
It was really looking at the available sources that were in the marketplace, and then financial sources, that is, and then also looking at the demand in the neighborhoods of really what we wanted to achieve and what we thought would be good for the community. The alder of the district, Alderwoman Dmitrievich, was instrumental in looking at it and assisting us with deciding that there should be a senior component, a family component, to really make it a full community.
A senior component. Can you talk a little bit about designating some of this housing specifically for seniors?
Sure. What we learned through a process of working with the neighborhood, the city staff, the alder of the district, was that there really wasn't a lot of dedicated senior housing in the neighborhood. Oftentimes, a senior would age out of the neighborhood, need assistance, and then have to leave. And so we thought it very important to allocate 144 of the 576 units for senior housing.
So you mentioned COVID hit, costs go up, but zooming out now to the broader economy, SR, are tariffs and inflation and rising energy costs impacting housing construction?
They are, certainly. I think, you know, while we've accounted for much of that and some of the, you know, expected spikes in cost, really the interest rates are what's instrumental now and very difficult to put your thumb on as to where they're going to be. These, you know, the gestation time for these projects are, we don't look at it in months, we look at it in years. So it's always tough to guess where the interest rates are going to be a few years out.
When you're putting together these, you know, intricate funding mechanisms, are those obstacles to developing affordable housing, or is it more of the larger piece, like interest rates?
Well, I think they all coincide. Mm-hmm. You know, it comes back to interest rates, which, because there's a fixed amount of rent that comes in with, you know, the amount of debt that it could support, and then in turn, also the available funding sources that can change from time to time. And then certainly the costs, whether it's land cost or hard construction costs, that certainly factors into it as well.
The project site, it contained an old landfill. What is involved in removing that to prepare for a development?
Yeah, and actually this site wasn't as bad as many. Foundry sand is something that's very common in Milwaukee. So from an environmental standpoint, we've certainly dealt with worse. But, you know, certainly you have to be very thoughtful and work with the DNR and all of the various officials and environmental consultants to put down the necessary vapor mitigation, go ahead and extract any of the hazardous materials that might or might not be there, and then put the necessary caps down to ensure that there isn't any penetration of those caps to keep everybody safe and any contaminants in the ground, and so they can dilute over time.
And that can take time as well to make those extra steps.
It certainly can, time and money.
Developers sometimes encounter NIMBYism from neighbors who don't want new development next door or across the street. Have you encountered this with the Corliss?
You know, actually with the Corliss, it was, you know, I think a lot of people, including, you know, our team, myself, we really wanted to save many of the existing buildings. Mm. However, it was becoming financially unviable. So what we heard was, they wanted density. They wanted to create a neighborhood feel, wanted amenities such as the bike trail through the site and to make sure it feels like the balance of the neighborhood. So as far as the NIMBYism, we didn't encounter much. It was more so just making sure it's the right product for the area.
Were you surprised that you kind of had the opposite of that? Yes, we want the density here. Is that something you encounter in other places?
You know, we encounter it more in urban areas where there's an appreciation for, you know, keeping, you know, having great parks, having great outdoor space, but putting density where it is appropriate. Where we run into more of the traditional NIMBYism is in some of the suburban and rural areas. And while there's many instances where we have, you know, great partners and neighbors there, but usually there's more of an education process about, you know, what we're doing, and that change isn't, well, it can always be scary, it isn't bad, and we just try and do our best to explain it.
And there's certainly trust involved as well, I'm sure. What can the state, what can municipalities do to encourage more of this type of affordable housing?
I think a lot of it in the city of Milwaukee has done a great job on predictable zoning. That's something that, you know, we actually acquired the site prior to having our completed plans and the necessary permits. But we did so because we knew what was allowed by right. And so we were comfortable doing that, which allowed us to stay on a relatively tight time frame. And then really the predictable TIF assistance as well. For many of these developments, there needs to be a public-private partnership, and knowing what that looks like on the front end allows us to take one variable out of the mix and factor it into the overall project.
Do you see opportunities for other developments of this size in Wisconsin and this type?
I do. I mean, granted, this is a large development, but it's over 8 buildings and 10 acres in an urban site in a great neighborhood. You know, I think we just always have to be thoughtful of not overbuilding and also not underbuilding. So while I think there are opportunities for comparable size developments, it needs to be the right fit, not just big for the sake of being big.
So do the research.
Yeah, exactly.
SR, thank you for joining us.
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
SR Mills is CEO of Bear Development, which is the developer of the Corliss in Milwaukee. It will have 576 affordable units and 8 buildings. Now, the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority administers the state's low-income housing tax credit program and oversees a system for scoring the impact of a housing project on Wisconsin residents. It's called a QAP, or Qualified Allocation Plan. For more on this type of housing effort, we turn to Elmer Moore Jr., CEO and Executive Director of the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. Elmer, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's lovely to speak to you today, Kate.
You said that this project required just the right combination of luck, of timing, of capacity and collaboration. And Wisconsin desperately needs affordable housing and workforce housing. Why are these projects so difficult to build?
Well, for a multitude of reasons, including they are incredibly expensive. At this point, with the supply chain, labor costs, and in fact, the cost of capital being just so high, the per unit cost reaches well into the hundreds of thousands. And when you multiply hundreds of thousands times nearly 500, you get to, or excuse me, nearly 600, mm-hmm. you get to numbers that are truly astronomical. It's difficult for developers to secure the necessary capital, and it's difficult for municipalities and other funders to arrange all the right approvals and necessary resources to make these kinds of deals happen. So we're so proud of what Bayer is doing and impressed, because this is a very, very important development.
It makes me wonder, you know, how do you get banks on board to lend enough and take bigger risks on housing projects like this one with over 500 units?
The risk in lending to developers is more about the abilities of the developer to deliver the housing units and to operate them in a way that is safe, sound, and secure. There is very little risk investing in housing itself because it is absolutely necessary. We are undersupplied by tens of thousands of units, even in just the Milwaukee area alone. And so the opportunity to generate a return offering debt to developers is a pretty safe bet, so long as the developer, like SR Mills and Bayer Development, have a track record of delivering on their plans. And what we love to see is communities also investing in the developments that they so desperately need. So you see that in the form of housing funds, you see that in the form of TIF funds being directed towards housing development. But it's a safe bet for a community, and we'd love to assure more lenders and banking institutions around the idea that it's a safe bet for their balance sheets as well.
We also heard from SR Mills, who did say that the one thing that would help developers like him is predictable zoning. When developers have a clear idea of what's allowed before they buy property, are you seeing municipalities being more flexible and open to these larger developments?
Yes. The one place that I might correct his comments is it is one of the things mm-hmm. that would make this process much easier. We're seeing communities across the state really take a more proactive approach to making themselves accommodating to developments writ large, and certainly larger and larger developments. If you can imagine, you know, 576 units invites something closer to 2,000, 2,500 people to a neighborhood who might not have resided there before. It materially changes how a community feels. And so it should be taken very seriously. But municipalities must develop zoning plans and housing plans that incorporate these large-scale developments and the amenities that they support. Grocery stores, bike trails, you know, changes to traffic and so on. Because when we do that, we can really assure a clearer path towards success for that municipality.
The Corliss is considered the largest private affordable housing project in Wisconsin at the moment, but there have been large public housing projects like West Lawn Gardens in Milwaukee. Do you see private or public housing better able to provide affordable housing? Like, which way is preferable now?
There's an easy answer to this question. When prioritizing investments in public housing and investments in private affordable housing, the answer is yes. We need thousands more of everything. And so the processes for developing them doesn't truly overlap. And so we don't have to make that choice. They offer some different resources. Certainly public housing has the ability to employ resources that come from the federal government in a way that a lot of private development doesn't. Tax credits are one thing in the capital stack, but direct funding from whether it's block grant or others of the myriad capital sources, we need all hands on deck. We need all dollars directed towards generating housing that people can afford, whether it's public, private, or otherwise.
Looking at the broader economy now, we've got tariffs. You mentioned interest rates. Energy costs are also driving up the cost of construction. What can state government do to help developers deal with these higher costs and keep encouraging housing construction?
Well, you know, there's layers of government, and each layer has its own set of responsibilities and opportunities for improvement. At the state, you know, we're working on our qualified allocation plan, which is the governing document that dictates how we allocate tax credits. And we hope to be announcing the approval and the publishing of that very, very soon. What we want to do in the QAP is make sure that we're making it possible for capital stacks to work. We want to make sure that we are requiring the development of housing that is appropriate for communities, appropriate for families, appropriate for people with different physical and other needs. And so that's one of the things that we can do at the WETA level. At the county and municipal level, we would love to see some easing of some zoning processes. We want to encourage the increase in density in a lot of communities so that people can have close access to amenities, grocery stores, education, workforce development programs, and so on. We encourage the use of TIF funding and discrete housing trust funds that are raised by counties and municipalities, and that fill an important gap left by existing resources. And then finally, I think all of us have the ability to encourage unlikely partnerships. You know, Bear Development convened a huge array of stakeholders to make this project happen, including things like the Harbor District, including folks from the city of Milwaukee, Walker's Point Association. It took everyone to actually cross this exciting finish line.
Also to note that a portion of these units, 144, designated for seniors. Do you see access issues specifically for senior citizens?
Yeah, there's definitely a need to make strategic investments to support seniors and also individuals and families with different physical accessibility needs. And we can accomplish a great deal by making sure that our building code, and in fact, our QAP has accessibility as a primary concern built into it. But we definitely need to be very thoughtful and conscientious about matching the product to the community's needs. Seniors, you know, there's more concern than just the physical needs. There's a different sense of social engagement. There's different amenities that become important, things like healthcare, things like community centers. And we have to just really be thoughtful and strategic in how we design these things.
Elmer, thank you for joining us.
It's truly my pleasure. It's always a great day to talk about housing that's being developed for the communities that need it. Thank you.
That is Elmer Moore Jr., CEO of the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. Earlier, we heard from real estate developer S.R. Mills, whose firm developed a large affordable housing complex in Milwaukee called the Corliss, with hundreds of apartments.